Now, let's go to verse 1 here, chapter 3, verse 1. Now, Jehoram, that's a new name to you, Jehoram. Now, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria. Let me just introduce this to you, okay? You remember old Omri, King Omri. He was a wicked king. He had a son. His son was called Ahab, wicked Ahab. And Ahab was even worse than his father. Omri lived and died. Ahab lived and died. His son, Ahaziah, that we learned about last week, he died. And now there's another king on the throne. His name is Jehoram. Now you will note that Jehoram was also the son of Ahab. Let me explain that. Omri was the grandfather. Ahab was the father. His oldest son reigned, Ahaziah. He died. So Ahab's second son now reigns, and his name is Jehoram. That's how the kings were elected in that day. It was your son, your oldest son, or the next oldest son if one died. So, let me make the point. Here you have Jehoram, son of Ahab. He's from an ungodly line. But read through the rest of this verse. Now, Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria. So he's reigning over Israel in Samaria. The 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. Let me just, again, help you here. There's two different kings right now. There's Jehoram, he's over Israel, and you have Jehoshaphat, he's over Judah, Jerusalem. Those two tribes, those two kingdoms, rather, one with 10 tribes, one with 2 tribes, Benjamin and Judah, the other 10, okay? And they're both two separate kings, both living in the land of Israel, all right? Now, Jehoshaphat has outlived Ahab, he has outlived Ahaziah, and he's still reigning when Jehoram comes to the throne. Jehoshaphat was a good and a godly king. He was far from perfect. He really made some bad calls, but even believers do. And we're going to see him again today doing something which is a little bit curious indeed. But just because someone's a believer, just because they're the children of God, does not mean they have perfect discernment in every situation. We all make mistakes. And if you're saved today, you will know that. Two things I want to leave with you this morning. We're looking at Elisha and Elijah's God. We've been looking at Elijah's God. Now Elisha's on the scene. Elijah's gone. Elisha is his replacement. So we have Elisha and Elijah's God. The first thing this morning is this. Elisha and Elijah's God deserves, and demands exclusive worship. First commandment says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Commandment number one. And yet down through the ages, that commandment is broken and broken and broken and broken again. Maybe you're here today and you're breaking that same commandment. Let's get into this. Verse 2. Here we have King Jehoram, the son of Ahab. He's reigning over the 10 tribes of Israel. Verse 2, it says, and he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord. And your stomach kind of drops there, doesn't it? You have a new king on the throne. He has just seen God do great things, okay? Elisha has been taken away and his ministry has been justified in how he died. And the fires come down upon those army men. Remember the 50 men each army? The fire come down in Carmel. There's all these miracles, all these things in the recent past. And here's a new king coming. And you think, surely this king will obey the Lord. But verse 2 says, he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord. And you feel like grabbing the Bible and crying out, why is this? You feel like grabbing Jehoram. What are you doing, you fool? Do you not recognize that God, Elisha and Elijah's God, is Jehovah? Nevertheless, he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord. But, so there's a wee encouragement, if I can even call it that. But, not like his father and like his mother. His mother was old Jezebel. Old, vile, wicked bag that Jezebel actually was. But not like his father and like his mother. For he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. He put away the image of Baal. Now, I want just to Take that for a little minute right now. Here's this new king. He's on the throne. The Bible tells us he's every bit as wicked as other kings. But there was one thing he did which wasn't as bad as the rest. He put away the prophet of Baal. And the Bible puts that in for a reason there. You see, Jehoram, no doubt, he watched his father, he watched his mother, he watched his older brother and their fervent pursuit of Baal. Didn't work very well for Ahab, didn't work very well for Jezebel, didn't work very well for Ahaziah, his brother. So he decides, right, I'm not doing the whole Baal thing. Doesn't work. It's been proven to be a failure. And so he puts away the worship of Baal. Now, I must say, I have no doubt in my mind that would have given him something to boast about. If he would have met Elijah, he could have said to Elijah, hey, you know, Elijah, I am responsible for removing the prophet Baal and for the worship of Baal. He'd have boasted about it. And no doubt this would have promoted a degree of self-righteousness. You know, here's this land of Israel. We're supposed to worship Jehovah. You know, I'm the king and I'm removing idolatry. There would have been boasting and there would have been, no doubt, self-righteousness. But I want you to read verse 3. Look at verse 3 opens up. Nevertheless, he cleaved onto the sins of Jeroboam. And just to remind you, Jeroboam was the first king of this section of Israel, these 10 tribes. He was the first king, and he's the one who introduced the worship of Baal and the golden calf and so on and so forth. So here's what's happening. King Jehoram here, he might put away the statue of Baal, but he clings onto the sin. I want you to get that. Because sometimes people do that. They might take the self-righteous ground that, you know, I have done this as God has commanded, but in reality they're still wanting the sin, still wanting everything that goes with the worship of what they've put away. Now, he departed, yes, from bowing down to the idol, but he continued to live an anti-God lifestyle. And look what the word of God says here in verse 3. Nevertheless, he cleaved onto the sins of Jeroboam. Don't miss that word, cleaved. When you read that in the Bible, you think to yourself, Genesis. Where God said to Adam and Eve, that one, the man, the woman, will leave their parents and cleave on their husband and their wife. The idea of cleave is to literally become one, attached. You remember some time ago, it's years ago actually, we spoke on Eliezer. He was one of David's mighty men. And it says when he was in the battle, and he did a great work for God. And when he was in the battle, he took a sword. I think it was a sword, maybe a spear, whatever it was. No, it was a sword. It was a sword. He took a sword and his hand cleaved onto the sword. And it means that he held it so tight, it was like the sword was part of his body. All right, it was so firmly gripped in his hand. He cupped his hand around it, and he literally, not literally, but certainly, basically, was solidly attached to it. They were one. All right? And here's Jehoram. He is cleaving onto the sins of his forefathers. He's one with them. He cannot let them go. He's wedded to them. He's attached to them. He's holding them. Here's the point. You see, Jehoram, he was not as wicked as he could have been. Yet he was not as righteous as he should have been. I wonder today, is that like you? I wonder, is that you? You're not as wicked as you could be. There's much more potential. You could go out and do great sins and people will be horrified at what your hands can do. That's true. You're not as wicked as you could be, but you are certainly not as righteous as you should be before a holy God. Maybe you've seen, like Jehoram here, you've seen other people make shipwreck of their life because there are certain sins that they did. It might not have been worshipping Baal. Obviously it wasn't. Perhaps you've seen other men doing other things. I don't know. Maybe adultery or maybe some kind of bodily abuse. abuse or using substance, or I don't care what it is, but you saw other people do those things and you've seen how it wrecks a life, and you would stand up and say, I'd have nothing to do with that. I'd have nothing to do with, you know, adultery or idolatry or whatever it may be. And you'll take the self-righteous ground and say, I'm not that, but I wouldn't do something like that. Nevertheless, you cleave to all the other sins that there are. That's what this man's doing. Maybe this morning you harbor thoughts of self-righteousness because you're not as bad as other people are, like Jehoram. But let me tell you, when you stand before God, God doesn't make your neighbor your standard or your judge. God will judge you on his law, on his book, and he demands, and you'll get this in the tract, he demands absolute perfection 100% of the time. And if you cannot be perfect, you've broken God's law, and that's it. You're a lawbreaker. Doesn't matter what sins you've put away, you've still broken God's law. You see, men and women, be reminded of this. Jehovah is a jealous God. And he's not prepared to share you with somebody else. He's looking for a wedding commitment. He's wanting a covenant. And let me tell you, God, like a wife or a husband, isn't willing to share you with somebody else. Or what kind of relationship would that be? He's jealous for you. Jealous for himself. See, let me put it this way. Men and women, marriage is all or nothing. When you come to a church or wherever you do your vows, you do your vows, it's very clear. When you speak to your wife or your husband-to-be, your spouse, you say your vows, and it's an all or nothing. That's the way to summarize the vows. It's all or nothing. And that's the kind of God we have in heaven. It's an all or nothing God. You can't peddle with sins and also hang out with God if you like. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. Jehoram here, maybe trying to put away a few sins, but still disobeys God horrendously. Giving up greater evils, men and women, giving up greater evils does not make you righteous. Let's move on. Elisha's God deserves and demands exclusive worship. But second Lance, the final thing this morning, but we'll be here for a while. Elisha and Elijah's God often is blamed for disasters. Jehovah is often blamed for disasters. How often have you heard people say, there's an earthquake in Mexico? And you'll have pagans, they'll say, how does God allow this to happen? You'll have Protestants, and they'll say, why does God allow this to happen? And where are they today? Are they in church? Are they seeking God? No. But we're very quick to blame God when things go wrong. And that's exactly what Jehoram does. You see, Jehoram's the kind of man, yes, he's putting away some of the sins, but cleaving to others, he's kind of got a foot in both camps, and he's nowhere at all. Let's see what happens here. Go to verse, war is looming here. Go to verse 4. And Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheepkeeper, a sheepmaster, and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs, and 100,000 rams with the wool. And what that means is Moab was put to tribute. So Israel, the 10 tribes, the 10 tribes of Israel governed Moab, and Moab had to give them a certain amount of sheep. That was their tax, if you like, their tribute money. And they stopped doing that because Moab didn't want Israel to rule over them anymore. So war is looming. All right, let's go to verse 5. But it came to pass when Ahab was dead that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So he rebelled, all right, no more tax. Verse 7. Well, let's read verse 6. And King Jehoram went out of Samaria the same time and numbered all Israel. And what that means is he's numbering his army. He wants to see how strong his forces are to decide whether or not to go to war. So verse 7 is like deja vu. Verse 7, and he, King Jehoram, went and sent to Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, saying, the king of Moab hath rebelled against me. Wilt thou go with me against Moab to battle? And he, Jehoshaphat, said, I will go up. I am you. I am as thou art. My people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses. Where did we read that exact same language before? Jehoshaphat was also king when Ahab was king. And what was the last battle that Ahab had? He went to fight and he said to Jehoshaphat, "Will you come with me? Will you come with me?" And what did Jehoshaphat say? "I am as thou art. My people as thy people. My horses as thy horses." He's doing the exact same thing again. And you kind of wonder, Jehoshaphat, what are you doing? The last time this happened, the battle went completely wrong. In fact, God said, "Don't go, don't fight." And Ahab lost his life. Remember the man who pulled the bow, just an adventure by chance, a shot into the air, and the arrow came down and struck Ahab, and Ahab eventually died from that wound. All right. So here's the exact same thing again. Here now is Ahab's son and Jehoshaphat in a coalition. Didn't work the last time. Let's just look at this very closely. This time there's three kings. There is Jehoram, king of Israel. There is Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. And there's also the king of Edom. And Edom was probably, you know, serving the king of Judah in the sense that they were tributaries as well. And so by default, they would have to be there. Here's these three kings. And they go to fight Moab. Now, I want you to notice how they made their decisions here to go to battle. And what their battle tactics would be. You'll see from verse 6 right down number of times where they said, "And we'll ask God and we'll seek the Lord for counsel and we'll approach the Lord as to how we ought to go about this fight." I'm being sarcastic. You never read that. Never once do you read of anyone here consulting Jehovah. Jehovah, who is all powerful, who knows all things, who is altogether wise and mighty and good. Nobody thinks, "Well, maybe we should encounter of the Lord, inquire of the Lord." And so they go to battle, ill-advised. And when they go to battle, guess what happens? Guess what happens when you do something which you haven't asked God, it's not God's will for you to do. Guess what happens? Surprise, surprise, things go wrong. Verse 9. So the king of Israel went, and the king of Judah, and the king of Edom, and they fetched a compass of 7 days' journey, and there was no water for the host and for the cattle that followed them. They ran out of water. That's highly significant. They're in the wilderness here. And they run out of water, and the place they go to has no water, and they're dying, literally dying with thirst. Sometimes we use that phrase, "I'm dying with thirst." They were literally dying from it here. So what do you do when a problem arises? Well, you have a couple of options. Verse 10. Here you have the king of Israel, Jehoram. What does he do? Blames God. Verse 10. And the king of Israel said, "Alas, that the Lord," L-O-R-D, capital, "that Jehovah hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." No, he did not call them together. That's a lie. Let me tell you, this was Jehoram's making. He called the battle. He called the direction in which they march. He was the head at this. And yet when things go wrong, let's blame God. Humanity has not changed to this very day. Isn't it funny how we always blame God when things go wrong? Isn't it interesting how people all of a sudden who may be atheists or who have little time for God on Sunday or little time for God every morning or any evening, little time for God when there's prayer meetings, little time for God when there's special meetings, little time for God in their workplace, little time for God at any point in their life, and then when something goes wrong, let's blame Jehovah. Now, I wonder today if you're ever guilty of that. When you get into a jam, you couldn't be at fault. You have to be the Eve, don't you? And blame somebody else. And you blame God. You see, we ought to be giving God thanks at all times for everything that God gives to us. We ought to be rejoicing at him at all times, not only taking his name when things go wrong. Like I said earlier on, for the people who always blame God, where are they on Sunday? Where are they when this book is opened? Where are they when they should be on their knees praying? Taking up with themselves. Enjoying themselves. Doing their own things like Jehoram.
blaming God when things go wrong. That's fallen, corrupt, ungodly humanity.
And as a man, Davis, says, he says, beware of people who cite the sovereignty of God in order to make excuses for their problems and never cite the sovereignty of God in worship. And I have met that countless times. That's option one when things go wrong. Option two is verse 11. Jehoshaphat. And I know he has his faults and failings, but he is a man of God. Verse 11, but Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord that we may inquire of the Lord by him? I must say it's rather late, but at least when things do go wrong, he gets a rude awakening and he realizes his error. I never asked the Lord. He's not proud. He's not going to blame somebody. He just says, right, let's seek the Lord. And here's what I love. The Lord is always there to be sought. Believer, even when you do mess up, and we do, and the guilt sets in, and we feel so wick at how stupid we were, and what do? We're embarrassed. Your Heavenly Father's there. So lovely God, which we have, men and women. And so he seeks the Lord for a word on the matter. That's certainly commendable for this man. You've maybe read a sign in shops. I've seen that quite a lot. It's phrased differently, but sometimes like this. If you have a problem with our service, speak to the boss before you complain to all your friends. If you're ever on eBay, you often get that wee slogan somewhere. If you have any problems, speak to me before you unlike us or whatever the word is you use there. If you're on Facebook or whatever, that's the kind of the buzz phrase there. You speak to the boss, you speak to the owner before you tell the world and complain about your problems. And that's what's happening here. Jehoshaphat, he's seeking God, while Jehoram, he's complaining to everybody about how bad God is. So let me fly on here to get you to Elisha. So to cut a long story short, someone tells them that Elisha's here. We're not told why Elisha's there, but he's there. I have no idea why or anything else. But verse 13, it says, and Elisha said unto the king of Israel. So the three kings have arrived at Elisha's, door of his tent or wherever he's living in. Again, we're not told. But wherever Elisha is or wherever he's living in, the three kings arrive. And Elisha said unto the king of Israel, what have I to do with thee? What have I to do with thee? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and to the prophets of thy mother. And the king of Israel said unto him, nay, for the Lord, lies again, for the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. What Elisha says there is, listen, Jehoram, I have nothing to say to you. Not a word. I said earlier on there, in the case of Jehoshaphat, the believer, and I said believer, if you mess up and you feel wicked for doing something stupid and you sit down, you feel guilty, you go and your father is there to hear from you. That's not true of everybody. I said believer. Jehoram was not a believer. He goes to Jehovah when he's in a jam. It's like God is, as I said to you before, he's like a spare tire in the back of your car. And you only pull out the spare tire when something goes wrong. And something goes wrong, and he goes to God. And he says to Elisha here, we need to get the word of God. Elisha says, forget about it. The Lord has nothing to say to you. And some people think, I'm going to put off my salvation and I'm not worried about God today. And when things get bad, I'll go to God and God will hear me and God will just receive me because he's begging me to come to him. The wee poor God in heaven needs somebody to be his friend. That is not the case. Jehovah rules and reigns. And if you treat him like a spare tire all your life, do not be surprised when Jehovah says nothing to you. And you cry for salvation and you hear no response. Don't mess around with God. This is way too serious. He's way too powerful.
Let's read on. Verse 14. And Elisha said, "As the Lord of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee."
So Elisha says, because Jehoshaphat is in this, because there's one of God's men in the middle of this, all right, the Lord may have something to say. And I want you to see something here, because here's this man, Jehoram. He's an outright ungodly, sinning compromiser. Yet he's blessed because of the remnant of God that is with him. That's true of this land. God will bless his people. And because of that, even the unconverted receive grace and blessings. That's how this works. Verse 15, I would love to preach in verse 15. Sometime we will, because it's really strange. Elisha here is furious. He's fuming. He's saying, "I have nothing to do with you, Jehoram. You're an outright ungodly wretch. I don't want anything to do with you." And he's literally someone here who's really wound up. And he asks for a minstrel. Someone to come and play an instrument. Why? Well, let's read on. Verse 15. "But now bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass when the minstrel played, that the hand of the Lord came upon him." So here you have something here, a very, very important text about music, just in passing. That music has an effect upon you. It has an effect upon you. It can settle you down. It can give you ears to hear. It can prepare you even. So that's important. Why do we have music in our churches? Why do we have that time of singing? It's partly coming from truths like this. It's a part to play. Don't ignore that. Can't flesh it anymore. Let's move on. But here you have Elisha, and he receives a word from God. And just to bring this to quite a quick close, here's what he says in verse 16. "Thus saith the Lord, make this valley full of ditches. Go and dig holes in the midst of the valley, and I will fill them with water. There'll be no wind, there'll be no rain, but the ditches will be full of water for you, that you might live." Go on to verse 18. "And this is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord. He will deliver the Moabites also into your hand." So the kings came and they asked for Elisha to seek God for a word and help us in the midst of this drought. We're dying with thirst. And Jehovah speaks back and he says, "I will give you war. It's an easy thing for me to give you war. But just to show you who I am, I will give you more than what you've asked. I will give you victory in the battle." They never even asked for victory. Nobody even mentioned the battle. But God said, "I'll give you the water and I'll give you victory," because we have a God who is not to be blamed, but a God who is gracious and does more than we ever even ask. Yet this world would blame God for everything that goes wrong, yet in reality, God not only does us good, but abundantly does us good. This is our Jehovah. This is the God of Elisha and Elijah. Men and women, he deserves our worship all of the time. Not to be blamed, but to be worshipped. I wonder today, are you like one of these kings? Are you like Jehoram? Maybe you have messed up. Like Jehoshaphat. Maybe you have messed up and you've done things that are wrong. Seek the Lord. He'll help you. He will give recovery. He is keen to bless and do good. Or maybe you're like Jehoram, this fool, who only used God like a spare tire and found that God would not speak to him. And you know what? You see, when Jehoram stands on the judgment day, Jehoshaphat's not going to be standing beside him. It'll be Jehoram and God alone. And there'll be no mercy, because the time of mercy will have ceased. Men and women, we have a real God that you must have a genuine response to. And let's treat him the way he deserves. Let's take our hymn books this morning, please.